them if you want.
Bucks?
Bucks.
Wow.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, ours, I mean, our seats are like $5.
Yeah. Yeah. The ticket is good.
So it's the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
But, wow.
Yeah, it's... on that deck, and you're just there for...
Welcome, everybody. Is this on?
Yeah.
This isn't on. Can you hear me? Does it sound like it's coming on the microphone? Okay. I'd like to welcome everybody to an interim meeting of the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting. And this meeting is intended to provide a broad overview on the public utility rate-making process. The Public Utilities Commission is charged by state law with setting rates for investor-owned electric and gas utilities according to rules that are set up by the by statute. The rate-setting process has been in the news recently, or actually quite frequently over the past couple of years, due in large part to the more frequent requests for rate increases and the size of the rate increases that have been requested. In all fairness, until recently, some utilities had not filed a rate case for 14 years, during which time the legislature and the PUC have been suggesting more frequent rate cases to better oversee the impact of recent legislation on the utility rates. Utility costs have been impacted because of legislative mandates for renewable energy, for sulfuric oxide, nitrous oxide, mercury reduction, and energy efficiency and conservation measures. In addition, the legislature has placed in statute a number of cost recovery measures that avoid regulatory oversight through contested rate cases. In an effort to create a rate-setting process that is more transparent, the legislature in 2009 required the Public Utilities Commission to study the rate-making process and to report back to us by June 30th of this year. And this study shall include an assessment of the impact of automatic cost recovery mechanisms on prices charged and compare that to the traditional cost recovery mechanisms or to the rate case process. The legislature has essentially given the utilities authority over a monopoly, so the rate-setting process is something that the legislature and the commission recognize requires oversight. Most recently, an Xcel Energy rate case received media attention because of concerns over whether ratepayers were being asked to pay expenses related to travel and entertainment that some might argue should be paid by investors rather than by ratepayers. The Public Utilities Commission has been invited to testify before the committee today regarding how rates are set and also to comment on the recent rate cases before them in which there have been questionable expenses claimed for rate recovery, such as the allegedly excessive travel and expense requests approved by the PUC for Xcel Energy. The principal purpose of this hearing is to provide education about the rate-setting process so that informed decisions can be made on whether amendments are needed to the rate-setting process or to actually the rate-setting laws or the process used to carry out those laws. So before we get started, are there any questions that any members have? Okay. Thank you. We'll start, and I invite Dr. David Boyd, the chair of the Public Utilities Commission, to come forward. Dr. Boyd.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is David Boyd. I am a commissioner on the Public Utilities Commission, and I currently have the honor of serving as chair. Before I proceed, I should note that one of my colleagues just ran away. There he is. Commissioner Pugh is here, as is Burl Haar, the Executive Secretary of the Commission, and Janet Gonzalez, the manager of the energy unit for the Commission. This is the beginning of what I hope will be a dialogue to the extent you'd like to engage it with respect to rate making, and I'm afraid the old teacher in me went a little nuts trying to put together this presentation. It may be too much. I'll try and keep the level high, but as you might imagine, this is a very complex process. It's time-consuming, and labor-intensive. To the extent I can clarify it for you, that is my goal. If you have the handouts, the slides 2 and 3 really are just background information, reminders of what the statutory responsibilities of the commission are, and listing some of the core functions of the commission. The first of those core functions is to establish just and reasonable rates in terms of service, and that's the topic for today. On slide 4, I've just listed briefly the kind of unique role of the commission in having quasi-legislative authority, quasi-judicial responsibilities, and administrative responsibilities. And in terms of the rate-making process, it's the quasi-judicial part that's front and center. The rate case process is an adversarial, court-like proceeding. At the end of the day, the disputed issues are decided by the 5-person panel. And I can say there's great value in having 5 sets of eyes laid on these kinds of documents and proceedings. The perspectives of multiple individuals is very, very helpful. The 5th slide then identifies 3 ways in which rate making, broadly speaking, could be accomplished. The first is a general rate case, the formal process that will be the bulk of my comments today. But we do also have filings that come to us in miscellaneous dockets where there are changes in terms of service or tariffs between rate cases, but since they don't involve an overall change in the revenue distribution for the utility, they don't trigger a rate case onto themselves. And thirdly, there are the rate riders or automatic adjustment factors that are legislatively permitted in an attempt to incent certain types of activities or behaviors. There are 20 of those riders in place right now, and as the chair mentioned, we're working on a report to update you on the effectiveness, the pros and cons of that type of a process. So moving to slide 6, the goal of rate making is to assure just and reasonable rates to the ratepayer. There's an obvious focus on keeping rates affordable for utility customers. That involves assessing the impact of rate changes on various customer classes, the residential, commercial, and industrial ratepayers. However, it also involves ensuring that utility operations are efficient and that their financial profile is sufficiently balanced to keep their financing costs to a minimum. This is an important factor since they're so capital intensive. If their borrowing costs increase in any dramatic way, it feeds back into increased rates that go to the ratepayer. To give you an idea of the magnitude of these cases, the original filing for a typical rate case is probably 4 feet worth of documents that come to the commission, and then it grows in a mystical, magical way through the 10-month process. I printed off our e-docket system the final list of filings for a rate case, and it's 16 pages long of documents and filings. Now, granted, some of these are short one-page documents, but many of them are large batches of testimony, rebuttal testimony, and surrebuttal testimony. So these are very detailed, very complex filings. We're dealing with companies, corporations that are multi-million or multi-billion dollar corporations. We sometimes are looking at only a slice of their operations, trying to keep our focus on the parts that are, by statute, deemed important for rate making. On page 6, it notes that the rate cases have 2 components. The first is the revenue requirement, a laborious process where we work to identify the costs of operations, the assets of the company, and the return needed to allow the utility to provide reliable and affordable service. The second major piece or component of the rate case is the rate design itself, a process where we try to distribute that rate revenue in a reasonable way among utility customers by class. And the rate design process seeks to assess the impact on rate classes and set rates that give users proper price signals. We could spend a long time on either of these 2 components of rate making. I'm going to stick to the revenue requirement piece for today. I'd be happy to come back in a second go-around if you'd like, individually as a committee, to talk about rate design. It is also a very substantial piece of the puzzle. In terms of trends in rate cases, the chair alluded to the fact that rate cases had not been numerous in the 90s. Starting about 2003, locally and nationally, there's been a trend to more frequent requests for rate adjustments by utilities. Slide 7 shows a little bar chart of the number of rate cases that have been filed with the commission. I would note that 2010 represents only those cases that we know about right now, and that number is likely to increase, at least based on a conversation I had this morning. The deceptive thing about this chart is it shows a maximum of 4 rate cases per year. They are 10-month-plus processes, so there's a natural overlapping process. We're typically running about 6 rate cases at a time in various stages of process right now. Each of those rate cases will require 4 of our staff members to be dedicated to that process. We're an agency of 42 individuals. They're not all rate analysts, so there is a burden placed on the commission in this endeavor, as is true of the Attorney General's office, as is true of the Department of Commerce, OES, and clearly they're expensive and laborious processes for the applicants as well. These are not endeavors that I think the utilities take lightly. They understand the commitment that's required to carry these forward. So what are the issues that seem to be driving rate cases most recently? Infrastructure is a big one. Replacement of parts, maintenance of system, things like that. Lifetimes of transformers that might be 40 years. These transformers give out. Poles begin to fail. That sort of maintenance is expensive, and we're entering a cycle where maintenance, particularly post-2003 blackout, has become a more important focus. Renewable energy issues are clearly part of the process. The generation and necessary transmission to get renewable energy to market. The environmental improvements the chair alluded to, the NOx and SOx, mercury, particulate matter scrubbers and the like, and labor costs, which are generally increasing. And as I mentioned, this is a general trend nationally. It's not really just a Minnesota phenomenon. Slide 8 shows the larger investor-owned utilities which have come in and the number of rate cases they've filed. The chair is right. We had one utility come in after 24 years without a rate case, and that arguably is probably too long. And there are rate cases now that are starting to pancake one on top of the other, where filings are coming in almost back-to-back, and that creates its own sets of issues. The rate cases are not all that we do. I know you know that, but we handle a lot of other issues, resource planning for utilities, siting and routing of facilities, certificates of need for facilities, depreciation and accounting activities, service quality activities. We monitor conservation improvement programs, fuel cost riders. There is still that telecom industry out there somewhere that we're responsible for as well. And we have a consumer affairs office that handles things like the cold weather rule and mediates disputes for ratepayers and complaints. So we keep ourselves, I think, busy. Moving to slide 9 then, the rate case process is described in statute, and there are several sets of rules that also guide that process. Utilities generally are initiating rate cases, though the commission can call a utility in if it deems necessary after an investigation. When the utility files their rate case, it's effectively a 60-day notice to the commission of their intent to adjust their rates. The commission must act within that 60-day period or the rates can go into effect by operation of law. Consequently, the first major action after the filing of the rate case is suspension of their proposed new rates and the establishment of interim rates, which is also defined by statute and was one of the items that the Attorney General and Senator Anderson have proposed to adjust. Right now, the interim rates are deemed to be correct, proper, and legal unless there is a showing of exigent circumstance, and I believe the senator's intent would be to flop that around so that, as a rule, interim rates would not be provided unless there is a pressing need by the utility. These interim rates are a temporary rate increase really designed to be a make-whole operation, or at least that's my understanding of it, an intent to not penalize the industry for losing rate increases during the duration of the rate case. Let's see. Because of the relatively short timeline allowed for suspension of rates, 60 days, not enough time to investigate the rate request, the current statute orders asks the commission to order interim rates without a public hearing on the issue and without comment from parties. Though parties can comment on the completeness of the application, the question of whether the filing is really ready to enter into the record development stage. Once the filing is accepted, the commission must reach its final decision within 10 months of acceptance. Otherwise, the rate increase proposed by the company goes into effect by operation of law. Last session, that statute changed to give us up to an additional 90 days to process the request if necessary. Now we're going to start to get into the meat and potatoes. Slide 10 talks about record development. Because of the complexity of these cases and the controversial nature of some of these requests, nearly all rate cases are referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings for formal record development through a contested case proceeding. The OAH is responsible for developing the formal record on which the Commission must make its final decision. Once that referral is made, the case is the responsibility of OAH until they return the case back to the Commission. There are three important parts of this process: public hearings, which are designed to solicit comment from the general public, the ratepayers, on this rate proposal. The commission also accepts written comments until the record is officially closed on the matter. The evidentiary hearings, which are contested adversarial court-type proceedings, where formal parties present evidence that's subject to examination by all the formal parties. The statutes and rules do allow for settlements among parties. In fact, they encourage settlement among the participants in a rate case. Parties are often able to reach settlement on some of the issues. If those settlements are accepted by the ALJ, those settlements become incorporated into the formal record. The commission can then accept the settlement if it chooses to do so. If the commission modifies agreements, the parties have to agree to the changes before whatever the topic or issue is can be determined, decided as a settled issue. At the conclusion of the process, the ALJ prepares a report, findings of fact, and conclusions of law. That report has no force or effect until it's acted on by the commission. So the record development's done at OAH. They ship the record back to the commission. The commission has the final statutory obligation to act on the requests. The record is very dependent on the participation of formal parties. Parties with standing have an interest or a right potentially affected by the proceeding in question, and it's through this contested case process where a rigorous and robust record is developed. Slide 11 is a list of some parties we typically see at our proceedings. The first, of course, is the utility that's requesting the increase. The Department of Commerce's Office of Energy Security is a party. Their charge is to represent the broad public interest in the proceeding. The Residential and Utilities Division of the Attorney General's Office is a party to the proceedings. RUD is charged with representing the interests of small volume ratepayer groups, residential customers, and small volume business customers. And the last class is a mixture of ratepayer groups that typically come before us. The Chamber of Commerce typically is representing business customers, the Suburban Rate Authority representing suburban ratepayers, Energy Sense Coalition to represent low-income ratepayers, and then any number of different large power or industrial user groups, mines, paper mills, groups like that tend to collect together and come and act as a formal party in our proceedings to represent their interests. The utility costs that are included in rates, the commission's focus is on these costs related to rates aimed at providing safe and reliable service. As I mentioned previously, these are large corporations that may have multiple parts, and our focus is really on that narrow slice that deals with the rates and the rate payers. Only costs related to providing utility service to retail customers are included, and there are many categories of costs that need to be allocated or divided either by jurisdiction for a multi-state utility or by retail and wholesale or by regulated and unregulated utilities. Slide 13 just lists, that's what I just said actually, the cost characteristics. Some utilities have regulated and non-regulated activities. We focus on the regulated part. Some companies have both retail and wholesale activities. We were on the retail piece of it. And there are states that are multi-state, or utilities that are multi-state, multiple jurisdictions. We worry about the Minnesota slice of that. So all of these different costs have to be filtered, separated, and properly accounted for as we're doing our work. 14 is where the rubber meets the road, and I had to have one equation in here somewhere. It's occupational hazard. The revenue requirement, at least simplistically, the total revenue that the utility presents to us is the money they deem necessary in a typical year, a test year, to meet their needs and to draw sufficient capital for investment purposes. The way that this slide is laid out, there are three components to that total revenue. One is to recover their operating expenses, and I have a little list, a slide with a list of some examples of operating expenses. The second piece is the capital, the depreciation for that particular year, for the test year itself. The utilities build a large cash-intensive facility that it may have a 20-year lifetime. The ratepayers don't pay for that in a single shot. The cost is amortized over years and depreciated over time, so there is an annual depreciation component to the expenses. And the third term, which is perhaps the most complex one of the whole process, is where the value of the assets the utility owns multiplied by that little r, the rate of return, gives them a return on their investments. That little piece over there, particularly that little r, is a spot where we spend a lot of time and a lot of energy trying to determine what the allowed rate of return is for the particular utility. Keep in mind that there are some automatic cost adjustments, the riders, that don't play into this process, and we can talk about that a little bit more later. So, in setting just and reasonable rates, the Commission provides an opportunity for a prudently managed utility to recover its costs and earn a return sufficient to enable the utility to continue to attract necessary capital. To determine a utility's aggregate cost of attracting capital, the Commission must identify what types of capital are appropriate to the utility's operations, the cost of each type of capital, and the optimal mix of the various types to finance the utility's operations. When we talk about that little r, that rate of return, the key is to try and match that rate of return to the costs of capital. If we don't do that correctly, if the rate of return is too low, the utility will have a difficult time attracting capital. They may the borrowing will be inefficient. The construction of necessary facilities may be stifled. If the cost of capital is too high, there's an excess return provided to the utility. It might encourage excessive investment as a way to kind of bulk up profits. So there's really a great need to be very careful in determining that rate of return. The last nasty picture out of the whole thing is number 15, which shows a hypothetical capital structure. And to jump to the bottom line, the number in the lower right corner, 8.33%, would be the rate of return that falls out of this particular financial analysis. In the first column on the left are the types of capital this particular company might use: long-term debt, borrowing greater than a year in duration, short-term debt less than a year, some stock opportunities. The second column represents the percentage of each of those types of capital that go into the utility's portfolio. That percentage is a contested issue unto itself. That's a matter that's settled through the contested case process or addressed in the contested case process to find the right mix of debt and equity for the particular utility. It's done by comparing the utility to some of its peers in operation and in risk factors. The third column with these rate of return numbers, the first one is 6.32%. These are the costs of each of these different kinds of capital. And the first two, the debt values, are seldom contested. Those are easy to pick out with market information or from the utility's books. Preferred stock also tends not to be a terribly controversial piece. The one that's 10.43 in this slide is the highly, hotly contested issue. It's the rate of return or the return on equity for common stock. And that is a focus that several parties will address and analyze in the course of the rate proceeding. Provided you have the two columns of numbers, you can get to the last column by multiplying the first two together. 42.3% multiplied by 0.0632 will get you 2.67%. The return on return on equity, or the rate of return, is a weighted average of the different kinds of financing that the utility uses. So when you get these numbers, 2.67, 0.27, and so on, and you add them up, you get 8.33 at the bottom. That's that return on equity. That's that little r. That's the number that gets multiplied by the rate base, the value of all the assets, to help identify a return that goes back to the utility. It's important to note that this rate of return is an authorized return. If the return of it's the return the commission believes will meet the utility's financial needs while keeping rates reasonable. It is not a guaranteed return. It's still up to the utility to earn this return by operating their business efficiently to control costs, and it's also their overall return is still subject to demand, which is significantly affected by weather and the general economy in terms of utilities. So to the extent that we think of this is an automatic return, that would be an improper thought process. Number 16 is a little bit more on this return on equity, that 10.43 number, that hotly contested value for the return on common stock. There are different financial methods by which the return on equity can be calculated. The pros and cons of these and their application to the utility in question are all issues that the parties spend considerable time and effort debating during the rate case process. I really won't try to go into those now. We could do it later if someone would like to hear about it. Fundamentally, the process relies on the return of companies in a comparison group, again, a peer group of perhaps 8 to 12 companies that are similarly situated with similar risk characteristics. From that comparison group, a reasonable range for return is developed. It's from within this range that the Commission focuses its attention and applies its judgment as to the appropriate rate of return. There is clearly a discretionary element to this piece of the puzzle. So the process involves application of sophisticated theories in financial economics as well as the fundamental judgment of the Commission to get to the final impact on ratepayers and to the company. Slide 17 addresses that operating cost or operating expense piece of the nasty-looking equation. The fundamental standards used in evaluating what operating costs should be allowed in rates are whether they are needed for the provision of utility service and whether they are prudently incurred. And this is the point where issues like the travel issues, the leased jets, and things would come into the rate case. It's clear that from the recent media reports have expressed a certain lack of comfort or question about what's known and reported in these pieces of the rate cases. And I think this has been reinforced by the legislative and attorney general announcement of efforts to try and improve clarity and to restore consumer confidence or ratepayer confidence in the process. A couple of things related to the most recent rate cases. The most recent Xcel Electric rate case included a settlement among parties, which did include the attorney general, on corporate expense issues as part of that adjudicatory process before the ALJ. Travel was part of that of the original filing. It was perhaps not as clearly itemized as Senator Anderson bill might suggest, but the information was in there. Beyond the settlement, as part of that settlement, the parties agreed to enter a dialogue on developing policies intended to address review of costs in future rate proceedings. In fact, Ms. Gonzalez walked in today with the result, or at least a report on that filing, so I haven't seen it yet. But part of that settlement in the Xcel rate case was to try and address this very topic in a more meaningful way. There are two recent rate cases that had travel costs or jet-type costs included in them, and they were handled differently, the Xcel rate case and the first Minnesota Power rate case. The Minnesota Power case brought airplanes and travel up as a discrete, specific, developed topic through the ALJ and back to the Commission for a decision. The Xcel case, these travel costs were ultimately handled through a settlement. Different ways of handling things, but presumably leading to reasonable outcomes. The PUC announced that it would have an inquiry that would try to help build consensus on two questions. The first is what corporate cost information should be reported and in what form. And by corporate cost, I'm broadening things a little bit from just travel and perhaps airplanes. And this is much the same theme that the Attorney General and Senator Anderson picked up on. But secondly, and perhaps as importantly, what framework and process should be used to analyze the information in an effort to more consistently review and evaluate these filings. The information is good, but we still need to make sure we have an agreed-upon framework to handle and digest the information. What will be necessary to answer these questions? We're not sure if it will be legislation, if it will be rulemaking, or some other venue. But we are we're going to be convening a discussion among utilities and other stakeholders soon. I can't give you a date to get this process rolling, and we'd certainly be happy to keep you apprised of the process of that. Ultimately, and last piece, that there are two rate cases that were filed. I can't remember when. In November, and the parties in those two new rate cases were directed to specifically address these matters as part of the record design. Ultimately, this is a matter of trying to make sure that there is public confidence and trust in the commission and some sense of fairness with regard to rates. The resources of some of the parties like the Attorney General, the OES, and the commission to address things are finite. There are times, I believe, where people pick and choose their battles. If it's the case that topics like airplanes, lease jets are of highest priority, they can be moved to the top of the list. But I think the reality is that not every piece of this original four-foot document is covered to the extent that we might like or hope. Don't think that means that rate making is compromised, and I don't think that that means that there are egregious errors going on, but I think that is the reality. Last couple of points. The fact that money is spent does not mean that money is going to be assessed to ratepayers. A frequent example is the advertising cost for the naming rights of the Excel Center. That's a form of advertising that is not allowed into rates. The company knows that. So the fact that we see instances where money is spent does not automatically mean it will go to ratepayers. It has to pass through this process. And I forgot what the other point was I was going to make on that. Lastly, there's a couple of slides here that are really dealing with that question again about multi-state utilities and breaking up, teasing apart their costs, making sure we correctly allocate those. But the real punchline then, the end of it, is slide 20, which says, now we have a revenue requirement in hand. We believe we've found the correct amount of money that's required for the utility to provide reliable, safe, and efficient service and sufficient to draw investment for their capital needs. Now we need to distribute that rate increase across ratepayer groups. That's a separate process where we do rate design to come up with rate structure. That process is guided by what's called a class cost of service study, which tries to match the cost that different rate groups bring to the process with the amount of revenue that they're assigned, and then also tries to devise a reasonable balance between fixed charges like monthly customer charges versus usage charges, the per kilowatt hour or per therm usage in a gas case. That in and of itself is a whole other conversation. And if you'd like, I'd certainly be happy to come back and review that with you. Lastly, I'd say, besides the commission and our staff, we have other resources that we can point you towards if you'd like. They might be websites. They might be PowerPoints we've collected. And if you're really gung-ho, there are rate schools. You can go off to a university and spend 2 or 3 days getting your hands dirty doing this rate work. So there are all kinds of different opportunities available if you'd like to know more about this. Thank you, and I'd be happy to try and answer questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And it's obvious that this is a very tedious, thoughtful process and one that requires significant research and consideration on the part of the commissioners and staff in order to come up with your decisions. I do have a number of questions I'm wondering if I could get you to respond to. Often there's a gap between the rate increase requested by a utility and the increase that is ultimately approved by the PUC. Can you explain why this pattern is occurring, and are utilities, for instance, intentionally requesting higher rates than they need because they know their requested rate will be reduced?
Madam Chair, I really can't answer that question. Perhaps one of the other parties that will follow me can better answer that. That's clearly the recent trend. I can't speak to whether that is the trend going back years and years. I actually wondered if the interim rate statute, if you go back far enough historically, there weren't interim rates. The utilities were allowed to place their new rates in place at day one when they made the request, as happens in other industries. That was changed to our current interim rate process. And I, actually wonder, I haven't asked anyone this question, but I actually wonder if it wasn't the case that interim rates and final rates, or rate requests and final rates, more closely matched, so there really was no worry about whether there was an excess amount of money collected from ratepayers during the proceeding.
But even the requested rate is often dropped for the final request.
And well, I think that's when the various parties start engaging in dialogue or debate with the utilities. I think the utilities have been known to remove or lower parts of their rate requests. It happened in the XL Electric case, where some of the corporate entertainment costs were diminished after the Attorney General became involved in analyzing the case. But as to the sheer magnitude of difference, I don't know if it's a game. I'm sure the utilities sincerely believe they need all of the money they ask for. There appears to be a difference of opinion at the end of the day between what they ask for and what the commission grants.
I'm wondering, Dr. Haar, can you shed any more light on that?
I'm glad you asked, Dr. Haar.
For the record, Burl Haar, Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. Well, I think Chair Boyd did a very good job of responding to that question. Whether it's a strategic part of the utilities filing is difficult to say. Certainly, the Commission relies a great deal on the active involvement of the parties, and through that process, we believe that the record shows, the truth of the matter and gets to the nub of what resources are really required for a provision of utility services. Where that initial number is set by the utilities, it is up to the utility, does tend to be higher than the final rates. Typically, the rates are reduced down. Whether there's been a significant increase in that difference over the years, I haven't done research on that. I don't know. I could do that, but it does tend to be the nature of the process.
And I'm wondering, probably it involves some expenses being allowed or disallowed, and a change in that pattern as you go through the whole rate case?
Madam Chair, when that file comes back to us from the Office of Administrative Hearings, there can be, I think we had one rate case where we had something on the order of 70 or 75 separate decisions to make on different issues one by one that remain contested. And it's impossible for us to know what the impact of any it would be possible for us to know what the impact of any one decision might be as you're going through processing these. It's impossible to know what the cumulative effect of all of them are. And I think there's a sense sometimes that the commission might be aiming for a number, and I think that's almost impossible to aim for a number, particularly when you get to that return on equity question, that ROE, that 10.43 number, which plays into the rate of return, which plays so heavily into the revenue requirement. It's really hard to steer towards a number, to guide towards a number. You make a series of individual judgments about expenses, about the structure of the capital structure, and so on. And then I walked out of one of my first rate cases, and I asked staff, what's the result? And they said, we won't know for a couple of days. It'll take us that long to crunch the numbers together and see what's just fallen out of this.
Okay. How consistent are is it related to this?
Madam Chair, go ahead, and then I'll come in if that's right.
I have a series of questions. If
it's related to interim rates. My question is on interim rates. So wherever that fits in is fine.
Okay. My question is, how consistent are the rates from one company to another within Minnesota?
I may have to fall to Dr. Haar on that. There are differences from company to company. Their fuels they use, their costs of delivering and providing service. There are some built-in differences for a northern Minnesota or a western Minnesota utility versus one that might be more primarily based in the metro. Having said that, I think they're reasonably consistent. There are questions as we go into bringing the RES online as to whether utilities are using more wind or more biomass. Some of those questions will help, I think, make potentially even larger differences. Some utilities have invested more heavily than others, which leads to a larger rate base, which can lead to a larger cost. So I'm going to hedge and say, if you bear in mind that there are basic differences in the structure and style of these companies, even with that, I think that there is fairly consistent on a per kilowatt hour, residential per kilowatt hour basis.
Dr. Hart?
I would certainly agree with that. There are differences between companies. They have different load characteristics. They have different resource portfolios. So there are going to be differences. However, they all operate in pretty much the same climate, and many of them, you know, rely on resources that are very similar. So there is some consistency. I don't have a company by company comparison. Again, I could be happy to try and provide that if you would like it. But I think the differences between the companies are driven largely by their capital, their capital needs, and the nature of their loads.
Okay. Does the PUC have the resources and the authority that they need to adequately perform their rate setting duties? Is there something the legislature could provide that would assist you in this?
I'm not sure what the proper delicate answer is to that question. We are a busy agency. We have analysts who put in their shares of nights and weekends trying to meet our statutory deadlines. I hesitate to say we need staff because I'm not sure those are words that are well received in an economic environment that's difficult, even though our analysts bill their time back to utilities. So essentially, you could remove the PUC from the state budget tomorrow. There'd be no benefit to the state of affairs. If rate cases continue at the volume they are at, and if things like wind development transmission projects continue at the pace they're at, we will find it more and more difficult to keep up with our workload. I think that's a fair and hopefully delicate way of answering the question. From a statutory standpoint, I think we're good. I think that the policies that are expressed in statute are acceptable. The interim rate proposal is not one that I think we would probably comment on other than to make sure we understand the mechanics of implementation. Some definitions about what necessity means and some guidance on how we input that. But I think right now we're equipped with tools that help us to do the work legislatively, statutorily, with tools and rules that help us do the work well.
So when there's a rate case, the cost of your time and your resources are billed back to the utility?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
I believe our about 90,
almost 100%. It's we recover virtually 100% of our costs. So we're a fee funded, pretty much totally fee funded agency for our operating.
Do you expect the frequency trend of rate cases to continue at the rate they are currently?
Madam Chair, I see no reason to expect it to lessen based on what we see in other jurisdictions. I think we're in a period of capital growth, capital expansion, and so I would anticipate continuing to be busy.
Madam Chair, if I might just add,
if
it was just rate cases that we had to do, that would be one thing, but we have a lot of rate cases, as we've been talking about. Plus, we have a lot of other things to do as well. And energy is a hot topic, and it's certainly something the legislature has rightfully focused its attention on. And part of the fallout from that is the commission has been given significantly greater responsibilities. And we have those things to take care of, too, and we want to do a responsible job about carrying out those responsibilities. And it all takes time and resources.
And, Madam Chair, one other thing.
Commissioner Boyd.
I would guess that if you asked the question about resources of the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General's office, you'd hear similar responses or concerns. In one sense, staffing up the PUC without having Commerce and the Attorney General's office comparably and properly staffed is not necessarily – we can turn the paper, but the quality of the work that comes out may not rise in a proportionate manner with our extra staffing.
How about compared with other public utility commissions around the country? What is your staffing ratio?
Madam Chair, we are 40, depends on how you count bodies, because we have people in Commerce who serve a function that would be within one agency in other states, but we are either 43rd or 48th on a per capita basis.
I do this periodic for typically for our budget presentation. Senator Anderson is used to hearing these numbers. I do it calculate our staff size on a per capita basis. On that basis, just the commission staff, we rank 47th, at least the last time I did the calculation. If you include the Department of Commerce staff, I think it bumps us all the way up to 43rd.
Okay.
We're a lean, mean machine, Madam Chair.
Do the rates that you approve fluctuate with the state of the Minnesota economy?
Madam Chair, to the extent that the capital environment varies, yes, but the capital environment isn't really a Minnesota microscopic microeconomic situation. So I'll leave it to the economists, but I think my answer would be no, that the rates do not fluctuate with a boom or a lag in the state of the Minnesota economy.
Okay. I would agree.
Dr. Harb, okay. Do you have an understanding of what level of rates would be so prohibitive that the public interest would require that a proposed action not be approved, such as at what point would our state become so unattractive to industry because the rates are so high? And does that become a factor when you're setting rates?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. And I think I'm anticipating what you'll hear from the next speakers, that in some instances we may be close to that point now, when industries like the paper industry are not only quite competitive domestically but competing internationally, and being an intense, energy-intensive industry, they're very careful and wary of even incremental increases in the cost of energy and the price that imputes into their product and then the loss of competition. So it is a factor. I don't know that I could quote you a number. I suspect someone else might quote you a number, but I think in certain instances, in certain markets, we're approaching that. But I would also caution that domestically, everybody's electricity is going up domestically. There are still quite distinct regional differences in costs, but it's the domestic versus the international situation that might be more problematic.
Where does Minnesota rate in terms of its electric costs across the nation?
I don't know the exact value, but we're on the low end.
Right. Madam Chair, I would say we do tend to be in the low end. Upper Midwestern states tend to have fairly competitive rates compared to many other parts of the country. Northeastern United States is much higher due to largely their dependency on natural gas, or at least it has been. The far west, because of their hydro resources, tend to be quite a bit lower. But we do tend to be, I would say, in the middle. That's a good way to describe it.
Okay. And then what concerns do you have about granting cost recovery for certain costs by statute without the cost being considered in a general rate case? And are there any preliminary conclusions that you've drawn from the mandated rate-making study that we charged you with to come up with a report by June of this year?
Madam Chair, I think when we do issue a report on riders, it'll be probably a mixed message. The notion of using an accelerated cost recovery tool as a way to help renewables move forward and for transmission projects is a good tool. I think that the flip side argument is that brings into rates only those expenditures and things that tend to put rates up without the balancing of some factors which are going down in parallel. And I think that's the cautionary tale that would probably come out of that. The value of the overall rate case is it's looking at the broad spectrum of costs. Some do go up and some do go down, and they tend to balance each other in some cases. The automatic recovery riders are looking only at those things that go up. And parenthetically, I think as much as we enjoy having itemized lines on electric bills, I think the riders are creating a great deal of confusion among ratepayers. They don't understand why there should be all these add-ons. I don't know that I'm advocating lumping them all back in and sort of hiding them, but I think it's understandable that consumers have a difficult time understanding each of the different detailed pieces of a utility bill.
Okay. Dr.
If I might just add, we are working on that. In fact, we have a stakeholder session coming up here at the end of the month to take input on that, to help us in that regard. I might just add that the automatic recovery mechanism really started and were driven in large part by the need to recover fuel costs, because that's a significant part of a utility's operations, because it had a significant financial impact on the utility, and to try and minimize the risks associated with that, these recovery mechanisms were established. Well, we've gone far beyond recovering just fuel costs now. The automatic recovery mechanisms have been used for a variety of reasons, public policy reasons in many cases, many times very good public policy reasons, but we're well beyond that. And I think it's important that we look at, you know, the impact of that on the rate-making processes, which is what we are doing. And, you know, have we gone too far, or is there a better way to accomplish those objectives? And that's what this study is looking at.
Madam Chair, one other point related to that.
Commissioner.
Another piece of the puzzle with the rate riders was to allow utility to invest, but not in and of itself to drive the filing of a rate case. The utilities need to get those expenses into the rate base in order to begin recouping their recovery. If there is not a rider, the only way they can begin to recover those significant investments is by filing a rate case. When we were in an era where rate cases were fewer and farther between, this was an effective tool to help bridge that gap.
Okay. One last question. Do you have any recommendations for the legislature to consider?
Dr. Haar?
We have no specific initiatives this year, Madam Chair. As I said, energy is an interesting area, and I'm sure there will be many things to discuss, and we intend to be there to help try and explain how it affects the commission and hopefully, you know, end up with a better end product. But we have no particular initiatives this year.
Okay. Well, we hope to continue the dialogue with PUC. I think it's an important relationship to build. Senator Koch, you had a question about interim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Rates. Boyd, just to understand, because I think the interim rate question is going to be something before this committee, you had stated previously there was no interim rate, simply that the requested rate became the rate until the rate case was settled. And now we have this interim rate, which I see as sort of a happy medium. Is there a quick and dirty explanation for how you determine the interim rate? Is it an ROE? Is it a percentage of the ask?
Madam Chair, Senator Koch, it's very well defined in statute. Essentially, all of the rate design from the existing rates remain in effect. The rate design, the customer classes, the distribution of costs remain the same. The ROE from the previous rate case stays intact. All they do is bring the old financing structure applied to a larger number that they've asked for in the rate case, and that in itself brings up the interim rate cost. So it's fairly simplistic. It's very tightly defined. There's not much wiggle room for anyone in terms of the magnitude of those interim rates.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Other questions? Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You briefly touched on this, but my question relates to pass-through costs of state-imposed fees or taxes like the dry cask storage. There was some discussion about as to whether this was always allowed. It was my understanding it was, as far as a pass-through. Will a state-imposed fee like dry cask storage be granted? Will the utility be granted a rate increase to pay that routinely?
Commissioner Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, I don't know if there, and here I'm showing my ignorance about riders related to casks. I'm not sure I know that.
There are none for casks.
Okay, there are none for casks. So if there are increased costs that come with additional casks, at the moment those would be brought into the rate base through a rate case, and they would be questioned as to the cost, the prudence, the usefulness before they would be put into rates, in the same way as any of these other costs that we've been talking about before. So I don't believe, to describe it as automatic might be a little optimistic.
Senator Vandergrift.
Yeah, just to add a comment, part of one of the additional proceedings or issues the commission has to deal with is looking at decommissioning costs for the nuclear plant, for the nuclear operations, and that's something we do periodically, and there's a separate funding mechanism for decommissioning of nuclear plants, as I say, that's really done outside of a general rate case.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Vandergrift,
have state-imposed fees or taxes ever not been allowed as recoverable to the utility?
Madam Chair, Senator Vandergrift,
Commissioner Boyd.
I'll peek over my shoulder, but I'm guessing the answer is no.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Boyd, or Mr. Haar, I was wondering, are there circumstances where utilities can make money beyond this 8.33% reasonable rate of return? I'm thinking of stories in the paper about utilities that have been very successful in selling energy out of the spot market, for example. Is that just some, you know, if they're really good at what they do and they got some excess energy and they can go sell it on the spot market during peak times, is that just pure profit?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble,
Boyd.
The rate cases tend to have a predefined sharing of profits in non-regulated energy sales. I'll wait to be corrected here, but from that structure, there is, varying by utility, a formula to help the ratepayers and the shareholders share in a wholesale type of a transaction. But beyond that part that is negotiated in a rate case, that moves outside the bounds of the rate case to that unregulated portion of their activities. So it is possible, I think is the answer, for utilities to earn more in total as a corporation than what's identified in this paper, not through the regulated portion of their activity, but through their unregulated portion, or in the case of other utilities, by having other diversified companies that are not necessarily energy related.
Right, and that goes to the item that Chair Boyd was mentioning earlier on about the parsing out between the regulated and unregulated and making sure those revenues are properly assigned.
So,
Senator Dibble.
So to be clear, we want utilities to be able to recover their capital effort to generate energy, to the extent that it's needed, you know, given a reasonable forecast. We don't necessarily want them to be able to recapture their capital efforts for generation of power that's specifically going to be going out to the spot market. I mean, it's kind of an optional activity that they would be undertaking, and that would be kind of at their own dime and at their own risk to make that kind of a profit. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Boyd.
Senator Dibble, that's correct. We don't want the ratepayers paying for the costs associated with that unregulated activity. And there are areas where if you have workers in an office who work on both regulated and unregulated, we need a way to mechanically separate and differentiate their efforts in one activity for another. We put one piece towards the ratepayers, the other part goes to the shareholders. So what you've said is correct. We are focused on what is necessary for provision of service to the ratepayers. What they do beyond that is their choice.
Great.
Senator Dibble.
Somewhat related question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is, you know, some of the discussion about electric cars has been the fact that electric cars, you know, are going to sit around at night not being driven and being charged up with energy that's being generated already and just kind of being wasted because you can't turn off the coal plant or the nuclear power plant. How do we think about that in the future? Do we think it's a good idea, you know, to allow utilities to sell that energy at some sort of rate of return that's outside of this number? I happen to think that might be a good idea because there's a lot of other associated public policy benefits.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that's an evolving issue, the financing of all of that. There have been, as you might imagine, a high level, high volume of conversation about integrating electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. Electric vehicles match well with wind, for example. The wind blows best at night when we don't necessarily have a way to do it. And there are questions about how electric vehicles might become, in aggregate, an access tool to help meet peak demand in the middle of the afternoon, mm-hmm. where a car owner, if they choose to do so, might actually sell electricity back to the grid. It becomes a storage medium and a storage tool to try and shave the peak. There are some distinct infrastructure issues to talk about, making sure the distribution system is adequately equipped to handle that phenomenon. There would be homeowner-based charging equipment to deal with. But I think there are some important public policy decisions about how the relationship between the car owner or the car owners in aggregate and the utilities interact, and those are evolving issues.
Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to kind of follow up on one of your questions about adequate staffing. A big part of my life has become a proposed power plant in my district, and there's been a very organized opposition to this. And one of the things that they brought up in several community meetings is the fact that because the PUC is so stressed on staff, they're going to contract the analysis of the project out, and they question the quality of the analysis and all those kinds of things. So in my district, there's a lot of concern about if you guys are adequately staffed and the quality of the contracted out services.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Boyd.
Senator Olsen, other than one study that we contracted out, I'm not aware of the kind of analysis you're describing going outside of the commission, perhaps in Commerce, but not in the commission. And my quick response would be that we are doing things. Quality has stayed high. It's just taking us a little bit longer to necessarily process everything that we have to do. So I can look into this and get back to you about the origin of that question. But I don't believe analysis of the type you're describing would go outside the House.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen,
Dr. Hart.
This is the first, I guess, I heard of any plans to go to use outside consultants for any work that might arise from that proposed project.
Madam Chair, that's good news for me because I have great faith in you folks, and so I can pass that message along when I hear that being brought up. So thank you.
And Senator Olsen, I will double check this and call you or drop you a note to confirm.
Thanks. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm not exactly sure how to get at my question, so bear with me. It's just a question that came to my mind because of Senator Dibble's question about the sale of energy in an unregulated area. And I know that after 2003, there was a lot of investment. You can see that in the grid. But part of that was related to the shifting, I think, and changing of where power went and not providing power in certain other areas. So if there are provisions that allow the sale of power outside of a regulated area and there is a lot of profit in that, what is there in our process that protects our consumers in the regulated area from having access, regular, safe, consistent access to power if power is sold in the deregulated market?
Commissioner Boyd.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'll take a shot. I think, first of all, the first question will be whether this utility has sufficient generation for their own customers. And assuming that's true, as we are working a bit more, instead of just utility to utility, but looking at generation needs more broadly in the state, before we would grant a certificate of need to construct a new generating plant in town X, when we know there's excess generation in town Y, we would be analyzing that more global need to see if there aren't options or opportunities to use that power rather than building new plants. And I think in that way, as we look at the overall generation capacity between service areas, between utilities, I think that's the first way we're going to try and make sure that we're keeping the lights on in a reliable way. If one utility does have excess generation, and it may be true now because of the economy being down, as an example, and there is no other need that's being expressed, no one else is trying to build a power plant in Senator Olsen's district, then that becomes an opportunity for the utility to engage in this wholesale kind of activity. But if instead of building a plant in Senator Olsen's district, we see an option or an opportunity to move that power from place to place instead of building a plant, that's where I think, if I'm understanding your question, where some of these safeguards come in. We are very wary of overbuilding the system for need that does not exist and imposing those costs then onto the ratepayers.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator, if I might add just a comment, certainly agree
Dr.
that
Hart.
The need process is focused on the need in Minnesota, and that's the focus. That's the ball as far as the commission is concerned. We have a federal policy, though, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that is really promoting energy markets where plants can be used across broader regions so greater efficiencies as a whole can be realized. And that's what the Midwest Independent System Operator has created. Midwest ISO has created an energy market where utilities buy and sell power. And for the most part, most of the power that's generated here is used here. However, there are transactions on and off that market, and occasionally we buy power. Occasionally, we sell power. There are those kinds of transactions. For the most part, though, the power that's generated here is used here, at least at this time. The transmission system, quite frankly, is not adequate to do really anything else.
I said, just to follow up,
Senator Sharon,
if the transmission system were there, if the capacity was there to sell outside of this regulated market, are there? When we do the rate increases or whatever other procedures you might have, do we have the authority, the capacity to make certain, to require that the needs of the regulated industry, when they're just a little further away, might be a deregulated area, that those needs will be met? Or does the industry have the ability and freedom to choose to sell their power wherever they want to based on the market's price?
Madam Chair, Senator
Commissioner
Sharon,
Boyd.
Through individual certificate of need proceedings when new facilities are proposed, we would look at that. In the ongoing integrated resource planning that all the utilities participate in, where they project years into the future, a pretty complex process, trying to project load needs, existing facilities, retirement of plants, bringing on transmission. They try to look ahead and project what their needs will be. That's a second place where we have a look at what's going on. But ultimately, if there's ever a situation where we think a utility was not meeting generation needs for its own customers or not meeting the needs for the state of Minnesota, I'm quite sure that the commission would step in quickly. I don't have any doubt about that.
Okay, I'm going to call on one more senator, and then I think we need to move on. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions about this kind of frequency of PUC rate cases. You had mentioned that there was one utility that went 24 years without a rate case, and I'm curious as to how that could occur. I mean, there's still infrastructure issues, labor costs, transmission costs, things like that. And so how would one get, a company get around asking to get some cost recovery for something like that? That's my first question, if you could look at that.
Madam Commissioner
Chair,
Boyd.
Senator Dahl, I think it's, and I'm speculating a little bit, but I think it's a combination of things. I think if you came out of a rate case where the rate of returns were because the economy swings, the cost of capital swings. If you're in an environment, your last rate case, where the rate of return was fairly high, and if you're in an environment with fuel costs being passed through on a rider, I could conceive of a situation where a utility and there's little growth going on, little capital expenditure going on for a period of years, I could conceive of a situation where utilities could go a long time. The chair mentioned 14 years for another utility. Those are the anomalies. Some of it depends on the system they're running, the types of customers, the loads, the peak load, to what extent it's industrial versus residential. Those are my speculations.
Okay. And, Madam Chair,
Senator Dahl.
Then on the trend, though, you said in the 90s there was very few, and now we start to see a lot more frequency with this. And trying to get a handle of what might have changed. I mean, obviously the renewable energy standard is one thing. But I'm curious to know if maybe the conservation plans that we have, is that factoring into these increase in rate cases?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl. The conservation programs tending to hold the load, total load down ought to work somewhat against the long-term trend of building more and more generation. But at the point we're at right now where the utilities are looking for renewables to meet their incremental 2012, 2016, 2020, and so on, renewable energy standards, we're in a growth phase, not just in generation but in transmission. And I think the interesting question will be to see how the utilities choose to respond to the increased load from renewables. Will they retire older, inefficient facilities? That's the message we're seeing nationally in other jurisdictions where large, particularly coal-based utilities have already scheduled decommissioning of plants rather than making the investments that would be necessary to keep those online.
Comment. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
I just need to make a feel compelled to make a comment because I do run into this from time to time, the perception that our efficiency and conservation requirements of a couple years ago are adding to the cost and expense of our energy. They're designed specifically to save money for both the customers as well as, you know, for the utilities themselves. And in fact, they're not allowed to proceed if they don't save money, if they're, you know, we need to make sure that we're not adding to required base load. The other benefit is the renewable energy requirements come in more easily when they're paired with the energy efficiency and conservation programs that we have.
But Senator Dahl's and Senator Dibble's questions and comments beg another question. Do you have the authority to call a utility in if you feel like their rates remain high because of the time at which they came in for their rate case and that they may be excessive for what they need in the operation?
Madam Chair.
Dr.
Yes,
Hart?
Yes, we the Commission does have authority to require a rate filing pursuant to a investigation of earnings. So that authority does exist.
Okay. Have you used that authority?
Not recently.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been very informative, and I appreciate your taking the time to meet with us before the committee.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like to now call on Mike Franklin and Bob Lee. Mr. Franklin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. For the record, my name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Director of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And what I'd like to do is take you through kind of three phases. One, some background in our interest in PUC rate regulation and how it's changed over the years. Give you some examples of things we've been working on in the last couple of years at the Public Utilities Commission, and then close with our recommendations of what we might do about it to the extent that there's obvious answers, or at least obvious to the business ratepayers. The Chamber, of course, is always happy to discuss the impact of energy rates and costs on customers, and we believe we've been a consistent voice on that issue for many years. Our objective, our mission, is to help make Minnesota's rates as competitive as possible vis-a-vis other states and other parts of the world. And many companies, the chair was perhaps getting at, do look at the competitiveness of our electric rates in Minnesota and look at them currently, as was stated, as an advantage, generally speaking. Minnesota is still and has been a low-cost state to buy electric power. We're concerned that there's been some erosion in that advantage in recent years in some parts of the state, and so we take anything that may jeopardize our advantage in competitiveness seriously. And therefore, from our perspective, the cost and reliability of energy is absolutely a jobs issue. In addition to our responsibilities in this building, some of you know that we are very active at the Public Utilities Commission and have been increasingly so in recent years. And what we've learned is that in some ways the regulatory process can be just as important as the policy choices that come out of this building. And the processes over there can be improved in some ways so that ratepayers have a system that is both more focused on the competitiveness of rates while also being maybe more participatory. Because from our perspective, that process has changed. Today, for example, a rate, which is a term that even I use sometimes to describe all utility costs, but a rate set during a rate case in some cases may represent only half of a customer's bill. The other half of the bill, or maybe 40% of a bill, is not covered in rates, and it may fluctuate dramatically with every new project that's built and financed by riders between rate cases because of the cost of natural gas and other fuel, the impact of the regional energy market. And, of course, I wouldn't sit up here and suggest that the rate case is not an important function, but from our perspective, it's less important than it once was in terms of the stability and predictability of utility costs. And as I've hinted, one of the chief drivers of this instability and volatility is the newfound importance on riders or automatic rate recovery mechanisms. These riders have become much more commonplace in recent years. I guess I wasn't aware until Dr. Boyd said it that there are 20. And they've become more commonplace as a way for the legislature perhaps to reduce the financial impact on a new project or a mandate on utilities by allowing them to recover their expenses before a rate case. Riders thereby reduce their risk as a result. And however, for customers, these riders often represent significant cost increases outside the context of a rate case. But they also, for groups like ours and for groups for other customer groups, they amount to much more frequent interventions at the Public Utilities Commission, which for us is a process that can cost tens of thousands of dollars and has yielded a series of unresolved questions and some undesirable results. And I'll go into that, just give you a few examples. I mentioned that in some cases, nearly half of a customer's bill might be made up of riders as opposed to rates. Riders also raise important rate design issues that sometimes can't be resolved outside of the context of a rate case. And to put you back in Dr. Boyd's chart, this final slide that talks about revenue requirements leading to rate structures and allocations between customer classes. This is an area of significant importance for us. We really, when we get involved in a rate case, we really kind of live in this box 20 here, more than even the first 19. From our perspective, high energy users, large customers, that is, are especially hurt by riders because in many cases they're passed through on an energy-only basis. Contrast to what might happen in the context of a rate case where some of the costs might be assigned based on capacity or demand. We're having some success moving that ball forward, but again, it's a difficult question in the context of a rider docket as to whether those changes can even be made. Forecasting energy costs becomes difficult for customers than it otherwise would. As I mentioned, the predictability of a company's energy costs may change based on a rider docket and may change dramatically even without a rate case. Questions arise as to whether and when projects funded by riders should even be folded into base rates. This came up in a recent rate case where we intervened and discovered that actually customers did better in the short term if the project that was being proposed to come into rate case, to the rate base, was actually left in the rider for a period of years and paid off over that time. We didn't expect that to be the result, but it's, you know, some of the questions that are now being uncovered. And I guess timing is everything when it comes to utility energy costs. And, you know, we heard a little bit about how, you know, and there's a temptation to say, well, when a rider docket is going on, there's this individual project that's being scrutinized probably more so than it would be if it were coming in as one project of many in the context of the rate case, and that's probably true. However, on the same coin, it makes it a little more difficult to get a sense of that project's importance in the context of the total cost to the utility. In other words, it's sort of the forest for the trees argument. And it, in general, it, our concerns sort of come down to a question of who bears the risk of new investments, and too often, from our perspective, it's the customer. And some recent examples, and I'm trying to be an equal opportunity testifier here, we intervene in rate cases of all regulated utilities. The Minnesota Power, a couple of years ago, sought $239 million in capital costs to comply with the mercury mandate for their retrofits to Boswell 3. We were very involved in working with the utility in that docket. XL, one of the first riders that we got it, had any experience with, was the MERP rider, which was over $1 billion all told to customers in capital costs. And we were able to negotiate a compromise in that case whereby XL got a higher rate of return if they were under budget and ahead of schedule, and a lower rate of return on their capital if they were over budget and behind schedule. And we had one of each. In fact, two were over budget and one was under budget, I believe, when it comes to the three projects that are financed by the MERP rider. I'm sure Mr. Clark will correct me if I've gotten that wrong. The most recent series of rider dockets that we've been engaged in amount to the renewable energy riders, which are, of course, coming up to fund the projects being used to meet the renewable energy mandate, and the transmission cost riders, which were approved, I believe, in the same legislation and in some ways are being used to finance transmission to meet the RES. We've been involved in two dockets with Xcel, over $44 million, and I believe that's a revenue requirement for their renewable energy rider, and $15 million for their transmission rider. With Otter Tail, we're looking at its renewable energy rider itself may actually be a bigger impact to customers. We're still looking at the total cost and trying to do some early comparison work based on the most recent filing, but it actually may be a bigger impact on on Otter Tail's customers than was their last rate case when it's all said and done. And then, as was mentioned too, the sort of granddaddy of them all when it comes to riders is the fuel clause, and we've had many years of experience working with the Commission and the Office of Energy Security and the utilities and ways and trying to get a better sense of how fuel is purchased and managed so that we can get a little more predictability and a little less volatility when it comes to that large rider. So to close, what do we do about it, I guess, is the question, and we've wrestled with that for a couple of years, so much so that we wrote a policy in 2009, which was approved by our board, and it was recently approved with some edits again just last week, called regulatory reform. And as won't be a shock to you, our concerns are focused on business ratepayers, and who many of whom are suffering just as our residential customers when it comes to utility energy costs. And further, as business ratepayers lose competitiveness vis-a-vis their competitors or decide not to expand or open shop in Minnesota, obviously their employees and your constituents bear a burden as well that really can't be calculated in terms of energy costs. Keeping our rates competitive, again, has therefore been the desired outcome for us in everything that we try to do at the Capitol or at the Public Utilities Commission. And so I'll just highlight five recommendations approved by our board and which will be available to you in our regulatory reform policy. I guess I'm not sure whether some of these are maybe more appropriate for the legislature and some may be more appropriate in rulemaking at the Public Utilities Commission, and we'll be participating in that process starting next week. And I guess I don't know which ones are which, but to go through the five. One, and this is a big one for us in our interventions, we really need to end cross-subsidies between customer classes. It sends a very mixed signal to customers when, on one hand, we're really giving incentives and encouraging people to conserve energy, and then at the same time, business customers are subsidizing the rates of residential customers. If we want to get a sense of where the true cost of energy is, we should set rates based primarily on cost, and that gets into that box 20 of Dr. Boyd's presentation. This may need to be a statutory change, or maybe it could happen in the context of rate cases. We've been making some individual progress on that. Institute an incentive system, kind of like that which I described in MERP and that we've offered in other utility rider dockets. Delivery of planned resource improvements that are on time and under budget maybe should perhaps earn a better rate of return than those that are late and are over budget. Create, and this gets to a staffing issue, and we're well aware of that, a utility ratepayer analyst within the PUC who could analyze and forecast filings on ratepayers' behalf and on our request, and who could perform this analysis sort of independent of any other group. It would just work for the customer. And this is a suggestion for you all, that legislative proposals perhaps should undergo this kind of analysis at the beginning of a proposed policy change. We think of it in terms of sort of a customer's fiscal note. And you've gone along with this suggestion to some extent in recent years on a few policy items. And, of course, any estimate is just that. It's an estimate. But it would at least give us some perhaps forewarning about some of the issues that we wouldn't expect to be getting into with the new policy. Perhaps those would come up in terms of if you're looking at the costs at the front end. And also look backwards and sort of take our temperature from time to time, and perhaps the legislature could set as a goal to keep Minnesota's rates or to actually make Minnesota's rates more competitive. There's no reason to suggest that we all couldn't be together with that as a goal, and maybe we should hold hearings on competitiveness and see how we're doing today versus maybe 10 years ago and 20, and what the potential impact of all the policy changes and the market changes in the whole country might mean for Minnesota. It might be an interesting topic to really spend a lot of time on. Of course, these aren't silver bullets, just some suggestions from our policy, but from our perspective, they'd go a long way to ensuring that a more transparent process whose desired outcome is a system driven by delivering the best quality product at the lowest possible cost, and we believe that's in everybody's interest. And as I mentioned, we will participate in the Public Utilities Commission's process and report that they'll ultimately deliver to you later this year. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and of course, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Is Mr. Lee going to present also? Okay.
Yes.
Maybe we'll take questions after you're finished then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Bob Lee. I'm an attorney, and I have been representing industrial consumers of power and gas before the Public Utilities Commission since it was founded in 1975 under a different name. So I have a fairly long track record of dealing with the problems that both you and the PUC are dealing with. My clients are the taconite mines in northern Minnesota, the paper mills, both of the oil refineries here in the cities, steel mill, and a number of other large industrial companies that are linked by one common factor, and that is that a very large proportion of their total cost of production is energy. And typically, these customers are faced with approximately 15 to 25% of their total cost of operations are tied to power or natural gas. And because they're so energy dependent and because they need to compete in every case in a global marketplace we have today, they're not only forced to place a great deal of emphasis on trying to conserve and use energy efficiency measures to reduce their consumption, they're also find it necessary to constantly monitor the utilities and attempt to ensure that their gas and electric rates are kept as low as possible. As a result, we play what I would think is a significant role in a many PUC proceedings, not only these general rate cases that we've been talking about, but all of these other miscellaneous proceedings, rider proceedings that you've been hearing about today. I guess I should say that how much we participate, though, is impacted in part on what the total impact of that proceeding is going to be on our bottom line. Now, in the case of a utility like Minnesota Power, we get involved in just about everything because my clients collectively buy almost three-quarters of all the power that's generated by Minnesota Power. In the case of Xcel and Otter Tail and the various other electric and gas companies that operate in the state, we play a much smaller role, although pay significantly large bills. And one of the things that I want to talk about just briefly is the difficulty that those myriad of proceedings creates for customer participation, not only industrial but residential as well. Like the chamber, my clients and I are very concerned about where energy costs are going in Minnesota, especially the cost of electric power. The recent number of large increases, not just in rate cases, but in rider revenues, have resulted in a pretty significant increase in the cost of our doing business. And I'm sure your constituents are telling you it's not just impacting industrial, it's across the board. But what we're concerned about is not just what's happened in the past, but we think that we're on the leading edge of a wave that's going to substantially increase the cost of power in Minnesota. And if you look at what the utilities are budgeting and planning for in the way of capital improvements, I think it's pretty easy to see that we're in for a pretty big run-up in the cost of power in the state. And that's environmental upgrades, it's renewable generation mandates, it's utility-funded conservation programs, it's expensive transmission upgrades to get to the wind farms, a whole plethora of different projects. But in total, it's many billions of dollars. And, of course, the utilities don't pay that. They pass it on to all of us. Whether or not you think that that there's wisdom behind those policy choices, I think that you'd have to agree with me that it's important that we have a set of statutes and regulations in the state that enable us to have regulatory oversight to make sure that those investments are prudently made, that the costs are kept to the bare minimum, and that ratepayers have a reasonable opportunity to ensure that they're getting a fair deal. In our view, that protection has eroded over time. In the early days of regulation, nearly every added dollar on the bottom of your utility bill had to be asked for in a general rate case and approved. There was only one exception. That was the fuel adjustment clause. And the fuel adjustment clause in 1975 was a pretty benign animal. It It was mainly reflecting minor changes in the cost of what were usually minor changes in the cost of coal and the cost of railroad transportation to get that coal to Minnesota. Purchase power was not a big deal at that time. So from year to year, the changes in that fuel adjustment clause were minor. Now, however, fuel adjustment clauses are highly volatile and are a much bigger impact on your bill. And there's lots of different reasons why that can occur, but there were some questions asked this morning about, well, can the utility sell this power on the spot market, and will that affect customers? And I think the general answer around the table was, well, yes, but we're paying attention to it. Well, I respectfully disagree. I think that the way the system has changed and the implementation of the tightly integrated utility system that we have over a wide region has led to a much more volatility in that fuel adjustment clause, and it has led to situations where if a utility's coal-fired power plant breaks down tomorrow afternoon, and this happens to be at a time when prices in the pool are very, very high, it can have an enormous impact on ratepayers. And we've seen that happen in Minnesota from time to time. The opposite can be true. You can plan a generation outage and hit the market right, and you can actually see a decrease in cost because the power you're buying on the pool is less than it would cost to make it yourself. But there's volatility there, and the dollar amounts are much bigger than they used to be. In addition, as you already heard, there are lots and lots of automatic adjustments to that bill that are, in my mind, confusing and are of a magnitude that is pretty astounding. I, before coming over here, I pulled out a couple of bills from two of my clients just to give you a flavor for what these numbers are like. And both of these bills were from, I think they were December of 2008, so they weren't real current, but they were what I had in hand. One of those bills was an Xcel customer. This was a monthly bill. Their bill was approximately $4.8 million. And of that $4.8 million, almost $2.4 million, almost exactly one half, was not in the tariff charges that were approved in these general rate cases. It was in all these other kinds of charges. The other bill that I looked at was a Minnesota Power bill of roughly the same time period. In that case, the customer's monthly bill was $5.1 million. And of that, about $3.9 million were tariff charges and $1.2 million were flow-throughs, either in the fuel adjustment or other rider charges. That's about 25%. I don't mean to testify that those numbers are precisely representative. These fractions change between rate cases. They change over time, and they're different for different utilities for different reasons. I just mean to say that looking only at rate cases as the regulatory model in this state is not the answer. And I think that poses problems for us. I think my friends at the utilities will tell you, oh, but the PUC approves each one of those riders. And that's true. They do. But just saying that ignores two fundamental problems. I alluded to one in the beginning. First, most customers, even the large industrials that are paying $5 million a month for power, can't afford to participate in every single miscellaneous proceeding that's filed before the commission. We have to pick and choose and look at the big picture items. If you're a residential ratepayer group, you can't even do that. It's simply impossible to keep up with all this stuff, many of which are not dramatically visible when these things are filed. I mean, you can't just look at it and say, aha, this is a resource adjustment rider and it's going to cost me a 5% increase in my electric bill. It's not possible to do. So in most cases, we're relying on the OES, the Office of Energy Services, to review and analyze those filings for us. And we're relying on the PUC to review that review. I think they do a great job, but I think the process was originally designed to encourage more than just a regulatory agency of our state looking at these kinds of issues. It was intended to solicit public participation. Second, I think it's fair, and perhaps Chairman Boyd would disagree with me, but I think it's fair that if you review PUC decisions on many of these adjustment dockets, you'll see that in many cases the PUC, I think rightfully, concludes that the legislature has already made the significant decision that their role is not to decide whether it was a prudent decision for a utility to build something, but rather to make sure that the costs they expended were reasonable. Their role is much different. Their role is much more diminished. And I don't think that's what Minnesota ratepayers really need. The system that the legislature designed 35 years ago was designed to create a vigorous regulatory system that puts the utility to the test every time they want to pass on new costs to ratepayers. In each case, I think that you had intended that somebody makes a judgment. Is this project really necessary? Was there a less expensive alternative available? Was there a way to delay or avoid spending that money? And if you conclude that the answer is yes on all those, you review what the utility actually did do to make sure that they kept their costs to a minimum once they got approval to build that plant. And then you need somebody to decide, okay, having spent all that money, who pays for it? Which customers should be saddled with the bill and in what proportions? Those questions are answered in every rate case, as Chairman Boyd and Dr. Haar pointed out to you this morning. I don't think they're being asked or answered in the same way with respect to all these miscellaneous proceedings. And as a result, the protections that ratepayers once had in this state, are being watered down. I think we need a prudency review of every significant expenditure by the utility, not just a fraction of them. I'd like to just address a couple of the things I heard this morning in the way of questions. One was interim rates. Interim rates have been allowed since the first day utilities started to be regulated in Minnesota. They were designed to avoid a regulatory lag problem. I think the idea is fine. I think interim rates have generally worked okay, but the track record has been that utilities almost always ask for more than they eventually get. I don't think that should be a surprise to anybody. But the problem with that comes about when you have rapid-fire rate cases one after another, as we did in the 1970s and as we do have today. And in that case, you end up in a situation where customers are always being charged more than reasonable rates because you're being charged under interim rates, then there's a rate refund, and about the same time they're getting the rate refund, maybe even before, they've had their new interim rates imposed again, which then eventually get refunded. So people are almost continually paying 25, 30, 40% more than the commission ultimately concludes is reasonable. And that hurts. That hurts a lot of ratepayers because timing is important. And I must say that, you know, I don't think that this is an issue that has gone unnoticed by the PUC. And in a recent Minnesota Power proceeding, they decided to do something about it and significantly cut back on MP's interim rate requests. I really think that it's the kind of thing that has to be looked at on an individual basis, not a blanket approach. Travel expenses. I think this sounds like a good issue, but I have to say that the dollars are less than trivial. If you made every utility exec walk to every meeting instead of flying on a jet, I don't think it would make a bit of difference to the bottom line on any of our electric bills. In my experience, the PUC and the OES and the OAG have always done a great job of policing those sorts of issues. I think I basically am in agreement with everything that's been said here this morning. I would have one quibble with a comment made by Chairman Boyd, and that is that I think that it is quite possible for a utility to earn more than a reasonable return between rate cases. I think it's happened plenty of times. I think it is the main reason that these utilities that have been out for 14 years or 24 years or whatever you want to say, the reason they're out is that they're making more than they would get if they came to the commission and asked for a rate increase. Their rate would go down. Now, why is that true? It's true because when you set sales volumes and expenses in a rate, in a test year, in a rate case, you're taking a snapshot. What does this utility look like right now? That snapshot is obsolete the moment that case is over and things change. In the case of Minnesota Power, which was one that was out for 14 years, at the time that snapshot was taken, sales volumes on the MP system were depressed, and we had set a very unrealistically low number, as it turned out, for wholesale sales outside of MP system. The price of wholesale power went way up to the point where wholesale was more expensive than retail, something none of us could have expected. And there was enough excess generating capacity for them to sell into the wholesale market and earn a very large additional return that more than offset those increasing costs that were occurring over that period. Those kinds of things happen. And I think they happen with some frequency. It is true that the commission probably can bring a utility back in, but it hasn't happened very often in the last 35 years, and it's a very difficult thing to ask the commission to do because if they guess wrong and they force Xcel to come in and file a rate case and they ultimately conclude, well, gee, Xcel is entitled to more money, ratepayers get pretty upset about the state fomenting a rate increase. So you have to be pretty sure that you're right and that rates really are out of whack before you ask for that sort of investigation. And that's a very difficult thing to see from the outside. I would say that my clients are in accord with the suggestions that the chamber is making to you on ways to address these issues. And we're more than willing to participate in the debate and offer suggestions when the time is appropriate. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, I'd be glad to answer any questions anyone has.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Are there any questions of either of these two testifiers? Senator Dibble.
I just wanted to comment on Mr. Franklin's suggestion of doing a fiscal note. When we come up with our good ideas and we decide it's such a good idea that we should do automatic cost recovery. I think that's a great idea, actually. You know, I think we need to look at a more holistic measure. I'm reminded of the arguments for the MERP and of course, the Mercury bill as well, in which, with the help of the state agencies, we there was a larger measure that was available that the PUC helped evaluate as well, which showed costs and benefits to public health. So, you know, that's kind of those are externalities, but helped, you know, help drive the rationale for taking those steps. So they weren't confined just to the cost of energy and the capital costs and et cetera. There's a larger rationale. So I think, we should take a look at. So we're doing cost recovery for this, that, or some other great idea. If that's such a good idea, what is that going to do to the bills that customers pay, residential or commercial industrial?
I've contended that for a long time, so. I'm sure we'll have further discussions once the PUC presents their findings in their study. Any further questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen. And now I'd like to call on Chris Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. As you said, I'm Chris Clark. I'm an in-house attorney with Xcel Energy, and I'm the lawyer who is responsible for our recent electric case. Dr. Haar and Commission Chair Boyd provided you a solid overview of how the rate process works and explained well the Commission's role and oversight. I appreciate the perspectives of the Chamber and Mr. Lee as well, and I'll try to pick up on some of the themes raised by all three of your previous presenters as I make my comments today. In my comments, I'll share the utility view of how the rate process has supported billions of dollars of investment in energy infrastructure, has resulted in reliable service at reasonable rates, and has helped achieve Minnesota's energy and environmental policy goals. And finally, I'll express our willingness to explore possible changes to Minnesota's regulatory system to ensure that we continue to achieve the solid results while adapting to new challenges that we face. To give you some perspective, over the past several years, Xcel Energy has invested literally billions of dollars to maintain a reliable system, improve our nuclear, coal, and gas-powered plants, add wind energy, and reduce emissions. These are long-term investments for a strong utility system. We've also experienced significant increases in the cost of our materials necessary for our business. These costs and these long-term investments are what are the key drivers of our rate cases and of Minnesota's and Minnesota rates. The Minnesota rate process, in our perspective, has worked well to allow us to raise the money necessary for our aggressive building program. And without this process, we would not have been able to accomplish so much. To be clear, these investments benefit our ratepayers. We use two different rate mechanisms to try to support these efforts, the traditional rate cases that have been discussed, as well as the rate riders, which have been discussed. In rate cases, the Commission sets prices which are designed to allow us the potential to recover our expected costs. For example, in these cases, we seek revenues for the $1.5 billion of new investments in our nuclear plants. And from this effort, we will get more energy, another 20 years of life from these plants. This will add carbon-free baseload power to help avoid the need for us having to build another baseload plant for many years. Rate cases also are a forum for us to seek revenue related to increases in the costs we face to operate our business. These include cost increases for labor, increased chemical costs, increased costs in the steel, which is used in the wire and in our transmission poles. They also include other increases necessary for our business, such as increased nuclear security costs and operating costs, and higher health care costs that all businesses have faced. Just to give you one example of cost pressure that we've faced, as we led up to our 2008 rate case, we experienced a 100 to 500% increase in the chemicals that we use to remove pollutants such as SO2 and NOx from our power plant emissions. Now, separately through riders, we've been able to make great progress achieving Minnesota's energy policy goals because we've been able to invest more than would be possible with just rate cases alone. And just you've heard some of the examples discussed, and I think you're familiar with them, but I'll go through just a couple to highlight some of the investment. For Xcel, we're investing almost $900 million in new wind farms that we will own. At the same time, we've been purchasing from community-owned and other-owned wind farms. And overall, this has provided a bright spot of growth through green energy jobs. It has also created a significant workload for the commission as they process the siting and permitting dockets for these wind farms. We spent about $1 billion to reduce emissions in our metro area plants, the MERP program, where we converted two of our coal plants to natural gas, and we effectively rebuilt our King plant. This significantly reduced emissions and gave us essentially new lives for these plants. We achieved over 90% emissions reductions on the profile of these plants. And there's some talk earlier about whether there's too much happening in riders and whether it receives the scrutiny it should. Our perspective is twofold on that. Number one, without the riders, we would not have been able to accomplish the Metropolitan Emission Reduction Program nearly as quickly as we did. And number two, we think the riders has actually brought more scrutiny to our business. As the Chamber indicated in their comments, it creates almost a mini rate case for them for some of these proceedings. And in the case of MERP, we were able to work with all of the parties to create a mechanism that incented us to bring in those plants under budget. One more example, we're working with other utilities in the CapEx 2020 initiative, where we're going to invest over $1 billion to significantly expand the transmission system. This will both increase reliability and allow us to add additional renewable energy from Minnesota and the region. About 1,000 megawatts of new wind energy will get access through the CapEx 2020 projects. I'd like to shift just quickly to the rate case process itself. Again, I think Dr. Haar and Commission Chair Boyd gave you a good overview of that process, but I'd like to fill in some of the pieces around how the practical side of how that process works from our perspective. For instance, the handout they provided shows that the process takes between 10 months, and they told you from last year's legislation it can expand out another 90 days. But just to give you an idea of the volume of material that's provided, it takes us about 5 to 6 months to put the initial filing together. And we provide the agencies, the OES, for instance, receives pre-filings from us that gives them an indication of what's coming. There are numerous parties that participate in the cases. In our recent 2008 electric case, the Office of Energy Security participated, the Office of Attorney General, the Energy Sense Coalition on behalf of low-income customers, the Chamber participated, a group of industrial customers represented by Mr. Lee and his partners, a separate group of commercial customers, companies like Target and Best Buy. The IBEW participated, as well as the Suburban Rate Authority on behalf of several municipalities in the metro area. And while we acknowledge these processes are complex, we think that each of the participants brings a focus on particular issues to that case. Many times, for instance, for the Energy Sense Coalition, they know how to target in on the low-income issues. The Chamber and the industrial customers focus in on the rate design issues and make that discussion lively in front of the ALJ and then in front of the Commission when it reaches them. The cases are document-intensive. We produce a mountain of data throughout the case. In our electric case, we answered over 700 information requests sent to us by the parties. These involved the multi-part questions, significant analysis, and volumes of additional information, all designed to allow others to get the necessary information they need to participate in the process. To give you some idea of the monetary terms from our electric case, we asked for a $156 million rate increase on an approximate $2 billion base. So our overall base is about $2 billion. We asked for an increase of $156 million. For a residential customer, that was about a 7.6% increase, which worked out on an average customer bill to about $4 a month. During the case, There's been some discussion about do we intentionally file at a higher number and then let the process take us down so that we always end up refunding to customers. Let me give you our perspective on how it actually works. We put our best case forward of what we think the interim rate should be. We will sometimes ask to move certain elements of the formula. It is a very formulaic process, but we will ask sometimes to move pieces of that formula downward because we don't want the refund to be excessively high. We want to get it as close as we can. So, for instance, in our rate case, we asked to move what we thought the return in that box that Chair Boyd showed you. We asked our witness, our expert who testified, said about 11.25 is what we should base our return on in the case. We recognize both the economy and we recognize the pattern in front of the commission in the past, and we lowered that ourselves to 11% and based the interim rates on that. So we do things to try to target the interim rate to the correct level. Additionally, during the case, there are changes. As we moved into that 2008 case, as you'll recall, gasoline had hit over $4 a gallon. There had been tremendous pressure in chemicals and steel and other commodities. As the recession hit, some of those prices moderated. So we work with parties through the process to get the number right and try to target what the number should be. That results in reductions. And so, for instance, in our electric case, working with parties, efforts that we made to belt tighten and make cuts reduced our 156 down to about $120 million. And at the conclusion of the case, after weighing all the information from the parties and the competing arguments, the commission approved a final rate increase of about $91 million. There was one issue in that case, how we treated the extension of life for Prairie Island, which is an issue currently pending in front of the commission. At that time of our rate case was currently pending in front of the commission in another docket, and now we'll be at the legislature. That one issue swung our case $40 million. Had the commission ruled closer to our position, we believe our interim rates would have been very close to the final rates. In our view, the commission elected to take a different approach than they had taken with the Monticello plant, and that resulted in a reduction down to the $90 million. That's the process working, but it's not us gaming the interim rate system. During the process, we also work aggressively with parties to try to resolve issues. There are a lot of issues on the table during these cases, and like most litigation, you're incented to pick the larger issues, the bigger issues, and bring those to the commission's attention and work out what you can. With the OES, we resolved issues surrounding the forecast. The forecast is a key factor in what you expect the revenues to be and therefore what the final rates are going to be. We had the opportunity with the downturn in the economy and through our own review of what the forecast would be to come in and suggest that the forecast would be lower. Likewise, the OES had done modeling suggesting they thought the forecast would be higher. We were able to resolve that issue working with them. Likewise, we resolved the travel and expense issues with the OAG. We wanted to focus the case on the important issues. We respected all the work they did on that issue, and we worked to resolve that issue in a constructive way and move through it and focus on the remaining disputed issues. There's been some discussion about how you treat unregulated sales. And just to give you some idea of how these cases pound through many issues, in a previous case, we had resolved how unregulated sales on our system would be treated, making sure that the benefits from those sales flowed to ratepayers. Issues that we don't resolve with the parties through the case are then litigated in an evidentiary process in front of the administrative law judge. He then provides, or she provides, the commission with an extensive report and recommendation. And then the parties brief and can raise any issue again with the commission, who has a hearing, who asks questions, and then makes the final decisions. The process is extensive, it's focused on achieving a fair result, and it balances well the interests of customers and the need for the utility to recover the costs of providing what we think is high-quality service. In addition to rate cases, we make numerous other filings with the commission. These provide for an annual review of our earnings and our financing plans. They review accounting and depreciation filings. They also get monthly and annual reports about our power outages and our response times and other information about customer service quality. And in addition to all that, the commission has the right and exercises it to investigate concerns that are raised by its staff, the agencies, or other parties. And just to respond briefly to some of the comments that Mr. Lee and the chamber made, through these processes, these things outside of a rate case, all of our rates receive scrutiny. The things that go through the riders received an initial look when we filed for the rider. They receive a look when a review and scrutiny when we asked to go build it. So in the case of a wind project, as we're building it, they'll get scrutiny. And then at the end, they get additional scrutiny when we come in to actually put those amounts into the rider. It does create work and effort for the agencies, but there is scrutiny there. We don't get a pass on any of the things that end up on your bill. It's fair to say also that we disagree that these things don't get scrutiny or that the system's not working. I think Minnesota has done an excellent job of using these tools, these rate rider tools, to advance legislative and other energy policies. And I think the challenge for you is, and the commission and the parties, is to have a discussion about, are there improvements that we can make looking forward to make this an even better system? And we're eager to engage in that. Just a couple of things about the rate process. Some things that I sometimes hear when talking to people who about our business. The process requires that we operate our business efficiently. It does not eliminate our business risk. It does not guarantee utilities a profit. We don't simply get to raise rates for every cost increase. We experience a reduction in revenues that occurs. And living in Minnesota recently, you'll know that cool summers or warm winters or economic contraction will decrease energy usage. And that's a good thing when you're a consumer, because all of a sudden your bill doesn't have a big air conditioning load on it. When you're on the utility side of the equation, it means that your revenues are now lower. That forces us to cut our costs and reprioritize spending. The risk is not eliminated. So we always have an incentive to work to keep rates low. And we've done some things, just like other businesses, to do that. For instance, we've made significant changes to our health care costs. We moved all of our employees to a high-deductible health care plan, and that provided significant savings. I say all of our employees. I think we still have unions that we're working with. So we've moved all of our non-bargaining employees to a high-deductible plan. We'll bargain with our unions on changes to their plans. We've made changes to operate our power plants efficiently and to use fewer vehicles by our crews so we can get more work out of existing equipment. Finally, rate cases are not a method where we go in and make up what we didn't earn. Instead, the rate process uses the projection of costs that was talked about earlier and provides us support to recover our capital investments. If our actual revenues are lower, for instance, if customers use less energy, or because our costs have exceeded what was projected in the last case, we simply do not earn the amount that the commission authorized or allowed. And to give you a perspective of how this has worked for us, in 7 of the last 9 years, we've under-earned or not earned the authorized amount that the commission's rate would have allowed. I'd also like to address the frequency of rate cases. We've avoided the need for frequent rating cases in part through our cost containment efforts. And our trend was for electric, it was 1992, 2005, and 2008. The current framework of rate cases and rate riders allowed us to keep long lead time projects such as transmission and nuclear moving forward, having the benefit of creating jobs and ensuring a solid utility infrastructure remains in place and is ready to respond as the growth and economy rebound. And to contrast this, other states have instituted regulatory systems that delay recovery of those investments. And the product you get from that is that it impedes utilities' ability to invest in clean energy technologies and necessary infrastructure projects. It significantly slows them down. Minnesota's rate process has helped us to advance energy policy and has created green energy jobs through investment in wind and renewable energy, transmission, emission reductions, and replacing our aging infrastructure, while at the same time encouraging conservation. These are actually big challenges. It's been a fun industry to work in, but it's also one, and this is a trend that is going to be faced nationally, utilities need to invest in their aging infrastructure. Our distribution system is 40 to 60 years old. That's the local lines that serve your houses and local businesses. Those wires and poles and all the related equipment need to be replaced. That will require more investment. Other utilities may be able to postpone that, but they can't get out of doing it. Minnesota System has put us on the right side of making the necessary investments. The process has still resulted in rates that are competitive with our region and has provided quality service and reliability and a system that's well positioned for the future. And we think that provides a good value for our customers. Our perspective is that the Minnesota regulatory process is rigorous and thorough, yet fair and well-balanced. And you have only to see some of the parties who came before me to know the kind of scrutiny we get in those cases that leads me to say that. The state agencies like the OES and the OAG and other parties are tough advocates for minimizing rate increases. The commission decisions have balanced the need for our investments with the need for reasonable rates for our customers. We recognize the system requires substantial effort on the part of the commission, its staff, and the other agencies. And we are likewise concerned with trends that show that we will continue to need to invest in our system and face increasing costs, causing the need for more frequent rate cases, and causing the need for us all to engage in the discussion about whether there are adjustments to the process that can keep us looking forward and maintain the balance that we have achieved well in Minnesota over the previous years. We look forward to pursuing those improvements and maintaining reasonable rates and financially healthy utilities. Those utilities will be able to attract the capital they're necessary and support Minnesota's energy future. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to share our comments today, and I'd be pleased to answer questions of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Clark, are there questions? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I wanted to ask, Mr. Clark, is a couple of things that the chamber mentioned in their issues that I didn't hear you address. One was the cross-subsidy issue. I mean, to what degree is that really impacting the different classes of customers that you have?
Mr. Clark.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, it is an issue that is always raised and debated extensively in the case. Our witness testifies that we believe there are subsidies of the industrial and commercial business classes. They subsidize residential ratepayers, and we put numbers. I apologize, I don't have those numbers with me, but we can get those for you to show you what we think that subsidy is. In contrast, the Office of Attorney General and others provide a different perspective, arguing that they think the subsidy is an inappropriate look at the rate structure, and that debate occurs. It was a large issue of debate in our rate case. It was one of the issues that remained disputed all the way through to the commission. It has also been an issue that gets discussed in riders. I think there is going to be an ongoing discussion as we use these riders about whether we need to add elements of rate design to try to get the who pays the fair share of each part of the project right. So our view is that there are subsidies. Our view is that the commission has been steadily working to reduce the amount of subsidy. I think it's fair to say that some of the other parties representing the business commercial and industrial customers would like to see that go much more rapidly. The other thing I would say is that it's different from utility to utility.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you for that. So it's going to be an ongoing discussion on that issue, I take it. And the other thing I want to just double check on this cost competitiveness, I'm hearing that we're kind of on the low end of the spectrum nationally, and then you mentioned that we're in there with the upper Midwest. Again, where are we with our neighboring states as far as our overall rates here in the state?
Mr. Clark.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we can get you some comparisons that show how we stack up utility by utility through the Midwest. I think what those comparisons will they tell you two things. One, they tell you who's higher and who's lower. The second, they give you some look at who's already started making the investments for the future and who probably is waiting. And I would argue maybe waiting a little bit longer than they should to get going on that. So you do have to take them with a grain of salt. Our perspective at Excel is that our rates remain reasonable. We're not the lowest cost provider in the Midwest, but we think we're still competitive in Minnesota with the neighboring utility systems in Minnesota and in the Midwest region. And our view is that the Midwest region is much more competitive than the West Coast and East Coast.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Debel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate, the testimony you provided and letting us know that when this issue of the travel expenses came up, you worked aggressively with the Attorney General and other advocates to get them out of there. But, the fact is that they were in there in the first place. And then after the fact, we found out about this, the private jet travel. Really no opportunity to address that after the case has been closed. So my question is, why should that be something that the ratepayers pay? Why doesn't that fall into that category of cost of doing business that the utility company has to pay for itself? And I appreciate earlier testimony that said this is peanuts in the grand scheme of things, but it reveals it seems to reveal a willingness to put into and ask for the customers to reimburse directly stuff that maybe the is the cost of doing business, and it speaks of an overreach and a desire to make money where perhaps Excel or a given utility shouldn't. How do you respond to that? And of course, it has to do with confidence of the customers, and particularly it stands in such contrast to these times in which we now live, in which people are really, really hurting.
Mr. Clark.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, thank you for the opportunity to respond to that. Let me give you an overview of the actual investigation that occurred in the electric case, and then maybe a broader perspective on the expense and corporate aviation issue. First, when the Office of Attorney General made their inquiry into this, they went in and looked at 2007 and 2008 actuals. Those are relevant because they drive the numbers that go into the projected year budget that Chairman Boyd talked about. And so there is a relevance to the actuals, although you're not actually taking an amount from 2007 and seeking it from a ratepayer in 2009. Now, that may be a distinction, and I suspect it is, that most ratepayers don't care about. And so I think that gets to the point of let's set the right culture. And as we engaged in the discovery process with the Attorney General's office, it was clear to us that there were really three categories of expenses at issue. One, there were things that we had never intended would go into a budget in the test year. Simply, they were mistakes of people coding things. Arguably, they weren't in the budget. The second was items that our policies allowed to feed into the budget for the test year, but as we looked at it with the Attorney General's office, we agreed should not drive the budget for the test year. For those two categories, it was very easy for us to say we need to agree to an adjustment to the test year to remove any question of whether those items are there, to give ratepayers the confidence that their money is being treated properly and that they're being respected in this process. The third category represented expenses that we believe are necessary, reasonable, and prudent for the conduct of our business. If you take a business of our size, if you take a utility of our size, these are things that you would expect your utility to engage in and be part of. So that was a third category that fell into the bucket of, we think we could debate this, and we think we could win if we litigated this in front of the administrative law judge and all the way to the commission. We were incented instead to take all three of those categories and make an adjustment to remove any questions. So we felt that we handled it by taking an above-and-beyond approach to taking those costs out of the case. And we did that exactly to give both the commission and the agencies and ratepayers the comfort that we had appropriately dealt with the issue. We also recognize the times we're in, and that's really not what the driver of our case was. And so even for those items that were legitimate, for us it was an easy choice. Let's just be clear to everybody that we're going to take this debate. We'll work on a constructive process going forward so that we can better demonstrate in our next case that those numbers that are in the budget are appropriate. And we've continued down that path. The OAG has been constructive in working with us in that regard. Likewise, other parties like the OES have watched the issue and paid attention to it and are watching it in our current case. And so we expect that we'll get the chance to prove that we have made those changes and that the amounts in our budget currently are correct. We did one more thing in our, we have a gas case that we filed in November. We finished the electric case. We filed a gas case. We went ahead and made an adjustment in our gas case to remove an amount for expenses based on the investigation the Attorney General's office did in the electric case. And again, we did that to give comfort. The final thing I would say from the broader perspective is that we do think things like corporate aviation give us a tool to more efficiently conduct our business. And we appreciate that the Commission has opened up a forum where we can bring that case forward and show what we think the cost-benefit analysis of that is and debate that with the parties like we always do in this proceeding. We recognize the stigma that gets attached to a corporate jet and the message that it can send. We also think it's an efficient way. It helps us do our business efficiently. And we're happy to debate that in front of the Commission. And we also recognize that this commission and other utility commissions have treated that expense differently in rate proceedings, and we welcome participating in that process and the results that it produces.
Senator Dibble.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And just to be clear, Excel executives can travel on gilded flying carpets for all I care, at top dollar, and they can dine at the most luxurious palaces in Europe. And that's fine with me. Corporate executives do that all over the entire country. It's the American way. Make a ton of money and lavish yourself with what that money can buy, as long as it's your own money. But you're not a Ford executive. You're not you're a different kind of company. Regulated monopoly type of environment. So I'm glad that the commission has opened up an inquiry now about the corporate jet travel. If you can make the argument that it's there's a cost benefit to it, and hopping on business or first class, even through commercial, regular commercial aviation, doesn't get you where you need to go when you need to get there, and you're gonna come up short because of that. I'm all ears, but I think there is a strong role for prudent examination by the PUC and other advocates for examining your costs and the costs that you're attributing to the ratepayers. This all follows, of course, on this issue of 5 or 6 years ago when Excel, put in for, continued to collect $300 million on income taxes that they never actually had to pay for their failed energy subsidiary investments. And I don't know if that was ever resolved, but, those things kind of tend to echo and reverberate and, makes us less sympathetic to Excel's arguments about, rate issues when we're having these policy debates around here. So, I'm glad you had this hearing. I am curious if we ever did resolve that problem, that $300 million in income taxes that we got to pay that Excel never had to pay. So, that's just my way of backdrop. So, let's keep having this conversation. I hope we continue to examine this issue.
Mr. Clark, would you care to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, thank you for your perspective and your comments. With regard to the tax issue, I think we can get you the answer to that. Our perspective was that it was properly resolved in the regulatory process and that the process respected the separation between NRG, which was a non-regulated business, and NSP, Excel Energy's regulated utility operations. I suspect, based on your comments, you may not like the outcome that was finally achieved, but we think it was the right outcome in the regulatory process. And I guess further, as your comments indicate, I think we do respect that we are a different company than others who are not a regulated utility. We appreciate that, and that's why we try to work constructively with the parties who are our adversaries in these proceedings before the commission and work constructively to resolve issues when they're raised.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Well, I thank you, Mr. Clark, and all our testifiers. I think this has been a very informative hearing, and I'm sure that we'll continue to review the input that you've provided and to have further discussions as the year progresses. Thank you.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.
Good, doing good.
Let me know. See you. Okay.